Hello, I'm Lina Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On today's program, we'll look at efforts to address gender equality globally. COVID-19 is impacting people's lives and livelihoods around the world. However, observers say women are being affected disproportionately in many aspects, and the pandemic is having a regressive effect on gender equality. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has announced a commitment of $2.1 billion over the next 5 years to advance women's economic empowerment, strengthen women and girls' health and family planning, and accelerate women's leadership. The foundation also released new data that show how the coronavirus outbreak has exacerbated gender disparities. For more on the subject, I spoke with Mark Sussman, CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Take a listen.
Mark Sussman, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
According to UN Women, despite the commitment made in Beijing in 1995 to take strategic, bold action on gender equality, progress in implementing gender equality globally has been slow. According to the report, not a single country today can claim to have achieved gender equality. What is your reaction after all these years?
Yes, so it's absolutely true. And I think it is a huge problem and an indictment of the world, because the Beijing Women's Conference was rightfully a historic moment for humankind. The inspiring vision that women's rights are human rights, that the sets of commitments that were made were strong and powerful, and people left energized and excited. And 25 years later, or now 26 years later, the world has actually fallen short on all of those implementations. And so our hope is that this moment in Paris this week, which marks that 26th anniversary, actually is a moment focused on action. That this time it's not just fine words. We need to have a series of commitments by governments, by the private sector, by philanthropies like us that are going to be measurable and accountable in the years to come.
And you mentioned what's happening this week. It's actually the Generation Equality Forum. Why is it critical, especially in 2021? What do you see accomplished during this forum? At least, what do you hope to see?
Yeah, so there's been a huge amount of work in the lead up to it from a range of committed activists and partners and governments. And the hope is that there will be a series of very concrete commitments. And we at the Gates Foundation will be making a significant commitment ourselves, a commitment of $2.1 billion over the next 5 years into several significant economic, social investments and a new program on women in leadership. And we're looking for other partners, actors, to do the same, that this is a moment both of celebration, because, you know, we do want to celebrate and note that there has been some progress that we need to pay attention to, but also really a call to action, that especially in the context of this pandemic, which has highlighted again how women have disproportionately borne the brunt of the economic and social impact, it is more important than ever that we keep them at the front end of our focus going forward as we build back.
So the Gates Foundation is committing $2.1 billion over the next 5 years, as you mentioned. Now, in three specific areas, these funds will focus economic empowerment, family planning and health, and also accelerating leadership. Why was it important to do so and focus specifically on these three areas?
Yes, so again, there are a number of tracks in other areas that other partners are going, but we were looking, where do we think as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we can make the biggest difference with our resources and our technical expertise? We have a long tradition of work in family planning and support around women's health, and so that is a particular area where we see great needs, because again, that's an area that has seen a drop-off in access to family planning during the course of the pandemic over the last year, and a rise in unplanned pregnancies. And this is such a key issue for, you know, agency and empowerment for young women across the world. And so we have investments in, you know, new technologies that will make hopefully family planning more accessible, easier to use, safer, And so that's a key area that has long been a priority, but we see redoubling in it as very important. Women's economic empowerment is also, you know, we've seen time and time again that when women get access to financial resources, whether it's access into bank accounts, to savings, to training through what we call women's economic empowerment collectives, which are often called self-help groups, when they can get access to social payments from governments, that they will tend to use those resources highly effectively, both for themselves, but also their families, investing in their children. And so that's the second area and why we think that's such an important set of commitments. And then last, women are just very underrepresented in global leadership still. That is probably the biggest indictment after 25 years after Beijing. And so in a couple of key areas, in health, in economics, and law, which are all priorities for us, we will be making some major investments, but we're hoping that there'll be many, many other partners coming in with us to invest in other sectors as well, because that's a critical opportunity over the next decade.
Now, more than half of the funds will be allocated towards family planning and health, which has been actually an important part of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's work since its implementation over the past 20 years. So, what lessons have been learned in the process, and to what extent have these lessons shifted the work of the foundation?
Yeah, well, one of the most important lessons, it seems like an obvious one, but you know, many people have fallen short, is how do we make sure we are actually listening to the voices of the people on the ground, women who have the need, that, you know, what is holding them back? What are the challenges in their households? What are the challenges in their communities? How can we include that? What do they most look for in a family planning product? What's most helpful for them vis-a-vis their husbands or partners in terms of their own being able to stop contraception and have a child at a time where their own choosing? So some of it is just that, building in a stronger set of, you know, a consultative engagement with the communities. The second is being actually more thoughtful about the sets of partnerships, whether it's with United Nations agencies, whether it's with national governments. You know, national governments, say particularly across Africa, have historically given very little resources into family planning directly. After 2012, there was a shift in that, and a number of countries like Kenya and others we've worked with, you know, have changed that and have started to make this more systematic. But we think that's something that we should need to build on and grow, and actually have partners in the government see that as a critical set of priorities.
When we look at the COVID-19 impact globally, many reports show that it has exacerbated the gender gap, really, men and women. The Gates Foundation released a new data that show pandemic-driven inequality is growing at an alarming pace. What were some of the key findings?
Yes, so one of the most important ones has been the hit on women's employment, because women have disproportionately worked in many of the sectors, from healthcare to retail to service, that have been most affected by shutdowns, even though at this stage there's almost been a full recovery in male employment globally. There are still 13 million women lost their jobs that have not regained their jobs. And the data that we have in the eye suggests that that's going to still affect another couple of million this year as well. So that's a huge gap, and that's why governments really need to focus and engage much more deeply on that. Similarly, we found on the plus side that when women do have access to social payments, which many governments, again, from Pakistan to South Africa to others have expanded, that those do have a big impact on keeping women out of poverty and providing them access to bank accounts and providing investments that they can put into their children and their families. And so we see an opportunity to expand those. But there's no question we need to have an explicit focus on the needs of women if we are going to come out and make this a more equitable recovery coming out of the COVID crisis.
As you mentioned, the International Labour Organization has reported that unemployment for women rose by 13 million in 2020. However, we see that with men, the unemployment has mostly recovered to pre-pandemic levels. So you talked a little bit about some of the solutions, but how can we really shift these disparities in the workforce in the long run?
Yeah, well, there are a number of areas. One other key area that, you know, part of our investments is going to come in is in childcare. that we know that women disproportionately tend to have the childcare burden across countries, and we've seen greater awareness of that across many developing countries, including many African countries, over the pandemic crisis, because we've had women having to spend up to 8 or 9 hours a day looking after children, particularly with schools closed and other challenges. And so a more systematic response that has governments and others providing support and institutional support for childcare is a key area which we're very focused on, and think this is a moment. This is true, as true in the rich world in countries like the United States, which do not have, you know, adequate childcare for women, as across the developing world, and, you know, in countries from, again, Bangladesh to Kenya, we've seen some of those challenges. So, you know, there are a number of key interventions like that, the economic payments, the care economy, focusing on some of the sectors where women are disproportionately employed, that we think can make a difference.
You know, it's an interesting fact when you talk about childcare, because in some cultures, women are the one to take care of the children. That's just how it's set up. So the dynamic around gender inequality is often linked to cultural norms and practices in many communities worldwide. So how can the issue be addressed effectively in such contexts when people are so attached to the culture, to the traditions, and what has been the foundation's experience?
Yeah, I mean, that is a very important wider set of issues, and we're very sensitive to that. And this is true for other areas that disproportionately affect women. It's true for norms around your child marriage, which is supposed to be eliminated in the legal parts of the world, but we know still happens across vast parts of the world. That it's true in gender-based violence, where we've seen significant upsurges during the pandemic as well. And so these are sort of social norms and issues. And I have to admit that, you know, as a philanthropic foundation, these are not our core areas of deep expertise. And what we've done is tried to be supportive of governments, say, like President Ramaphosa in South Africa has actually made a major initiative on gender-based violence, and we've tried to provide some, support around data and analysis of programs and interventions that work. But you're right, these are complex social issues and social expectations and social norms that, take years to shift. But there are still also policy interventions that can be taken by governments, not just the laws around the protections and the services, but also, encouraging training, providing proper support and places for women to help their children be cared for, that we think can make a difference going forward. And we'll be working with the World Bank and some other partners to try and identify some of those models that work even in lower resource developing countries, and share those best practices.
So earlier I asked you about lessons learned from the foundation's perspective, working on the ground in Africa and developing countries. When we talk about COVID-19, from your perspective, what lessons can be learned from that pandemic that has really shifted the way the world is living now?
Multiple lessons that go well beyond the gender equality thing. Certainly, one of the first ones is the key of long-term investments in interventions like surveillance, which is how you track and identify disease outbreak when it comes, where you need the testing, you need the facilities to be able to support, you need stronger health systems that are able to distribute vaccines, treatments, other diagnostics. This is an area, again, which predates COVID. As the Gates Foundation, we have significant investments in health interventions and health systems, including the availability of vaccines across Africa and Asia and other parts of the developing world. But this is just underlined for everybody what a critical set of investments this is, both for responses to something like pandemic, but then also to deal with the ongoing disease burdens we face all the time, of HIV, of TB, of malaria, because many of the same interventions, the oxygen shortages that we've been seeing being faced in many countries, so from India to Uganda, we're trying to put in place systems that prevent those in the future, and that will actually help for other diseases. That will help you for pneumonia. It will help you for complications around childbirth for women. So what we're hoping to learn is, can we take some of those lessons as a world and as a regional community, strengthen some of the institutions like the African Centers for Disease Control, which has been a really strong partner that we provide a lot of resources and technical expertise to, so that they are able to build on that and build an infrastructure going forward that leaves us both better prepared for future pandemics, but also allows us to engage much more with the real-time ongoing health challenges that are felt across the African continent and across the world.
We hear a lot about the lack of political will, whether it's about gender, inequality, or other aspects of development. When international organizations, when the global community is making its own effort to help these issues to progress, how can governments and leaders locally contribute? What can they do to see more results?
Yes. Well, one is to make clear, measurable, accountable commitments. So the Generation Equality Forum in Paris this week is a moment where we hope, as I say, the Gates Foundation will be making a set of commitments. We hope the world will be holding us accountable for that and asking us every year, well, what progress have you made? How many women have you reached? Where have those resources gone? What are the equivalents coming from governments? We need to see governments, I believe, you know, some leaders, President Kenyatta will be in Paris, I think, and others making some commitments. You know, we would like to see that happening across the continent and across the world. And what are the investments? What are the metrics that we're going to use so that citizens can hold their own governments accountable for making the engagement and the follow-up? Because, again, going back to what did not happen after the Beijing conference, historically there was this amazing set of commitments. It's still very powerful if you go back to read them, but most governments did not follow up with implementable, measurable plans. So this time we hope, and it's not just governments, it needs to be civil society, it needs to be the private sector engagements, but our hope is that this is an event that is going to have rigorous follow-up metrics, accountability. We hope that media like you will keep asking us questions in 3 months and 6 months and 9 months and say, how are you doing? Has it improved? Let's see it. I hope it wasn't just a big event in Paris, because that would be a real failure.
Before we wrap, gender equality is really a big task to take on. How will we be able to measure progress in the long run when we know that each country is different, each culture is different?
Yes, well, you'll start with looking at different targets and areas depending on which country you're in, because they will have different versions. Again, a country like South Africa, just cited, which, you know, has a huge gender-based violence problem, you know, needs to have some very concrete, measurable rums over there about, you know, accountabilities, about training, about, you know, holding crimes sort of responsible, about changing social attitudes. That in the kind of areas that I've been talking about, again, in each of those, in women in leadership, you know, there are core metrics. Are there more women in parliament? Are there more women in government? Are there more women in senior healthcare positions? Are there more women in your senior economic development positions? That's, if they're not, we need to redouble those efforts. Do we have financial inclusion? Do we have extra access to resources and financial inclusion and access to bank accounts for women? Are they able to have, do we have women back in jobs? Are those 13 million people who lost their jobs, women back in jobs? These are the metrics that we need to follow and be really, really focused on.
The message is clear. Mark Sussman, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you.
That was Mark Sussman, CEO of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Well, it's time now for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
I'm Hayley Adams. Join me for the next Straight Talk Africa, where we'll continue our in-depth look at the lives of those who have had to flee their homes and start over elsewhere. And we'll bring you part two of VOA's new documentary, A Day in the Life of Refugees. Join me on Wednesday at 18:30 UTC for the next Straight Talk Africa.
Burkina Faso-developed malaria vaccine is not the only solution to the mosquito-borne disease being tested in the country. Scientists in the West African nation have been breeding genetically modified mosquitoes that may reduce the ability of mosquito populations to spread malaria. Henry Wilkins reports from Bobo Julaso on Burkina Faso's cutting-edge research.
Laurence Sorge, the head of the Burkina Faso delegation of the International Committee for the Red Cross, said the organisation responded Sunday morning to a request for medical supplies, noting local hospitals are overwhelmed.
Upon request for support by the health authorities in Dori, we sent half a ton of medical support, mainly dressing, medicaments, sets of plasters, syringes, and anesthetic, which was really important to be sent with no delay.
Dori is a town in northern Burkina Faso. The attack happened overnight Friday at the village of Solhan, located in the Yaga province in the country's Sahel region. The extent of the carnage is not known because the number of dead and injured continues to rise. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, although analysts say it could be the work of Islamic State in the Greater Sahara. The attack is the deadliest since the conflict between Burkina Faso and armed groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group began in 2015. The violence follows a period of relative calm. Between March 2020 and April 2021, the number of attacks in Burkina Faso fell dramatically. Since the beginning of April, seven major attacks have come in quick succession. On May 17th, Burkina Faso's foreign minister, Sheriff Sy, visited Saba, the nearest town to Solhan. He said the situation in Saba was favourable and that peace had returned to the area. Mahamadou Sawadogo is a Burkinabe security analyst and former military police officer. Sawadogo said one could see this attack as a show of force, a demonstration of power by terrorist armed groups. He said that today they have shown they control the province of Yaga, and particularly the area of Solhan that they have been trying to conquer since 2020. Solhan is also the site of an informal gold mine that terror groups frequently exploit for funding. The military in Burkina Faso is under-resourced and is finding it impossible to provide security in all regions of the country, despite assistance from French and US troops. Lassane Sawadogo is the General Secretary of the Ruling People's Movement for Progress Party and says that, nonetheless, the government will do what it can. He says he has no doubt that at the government level and at the level of the defence and security forces, initiatives will be implemented quickly to put an end to this spiral of insecurity, which is stretching its evil wings on this part of the country. Aside from the number of people killed, the humanitarian aftermath could also be significant. There are already 1.2 million displaced in the country. Marine Olivesi is an advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council in Ouagadougou.
Beyond the sheer death toll, there are other counts to keep. How many families are going to be forced into displacement as a result of this attack? For how many weeks, months, years? And on top of that, there are things you can't quantify, but that are just as daunting. The trauma children bear, the fear of not knowing where to go to keep them safe, the stress of having to find a place to sleep or enough to eat. That's the kind of fallout we're looking at here.
Apart from a statement on Twitter, the President Roch Kabore has yet to speak publicly about the attack. A United Nations spokesperson said Secretary General Antonio Guterres voiced outrage over the killings. The spokesperson cited Guterres as saying the incident underscores the urgent need for the international community to redouble support to member states in the fight against violent extremism and its unacceptable human toll. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
Last year in March, when the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic, it had already proved to be lethal and highly contagious. It was a new virus with many unknowns. Since then, scientists have learned a lot about how it affects vital organs and its long-term effects.
Halima Cisse was due to give birth to seven babies, according to ultrasounds carried out in Morocco and Mali. But given the rarity of her pregnancy, she was transferred to a clinic in Casablanca for specialized care. A health team made up of 10 doctors assisted by 25 paramedics was mobilized for her delivery.
We were able to avoid a hysterectomy for this lady. Currently, thank goodness, she's healthy and safe. As for premature infants, there are 9, 5 girls and 4 boys. Their condition is stable, on artificial respiration, and they are those who have been put on oxygen.
Medical complications are common in multiple births of this type, but Dr. Yusuf Alawi said Cisse and her children are doing well. He added that this case of full-term birth is exceptional.
This is the first case in Morocco and rare around the world that a person gives birth to 9 children, not just in our clinic. We have witnessed the birth of twins here, but not 9. It is a rare thing in the world.
The verified world record for multiple live births is 8. This is an American, Nadia Suleiman, nicknamed Octomom, who gave birth in 2009 when she was 33 years old.
That was VOA's Justin Moulin Kenzedian. The beleaguered COVID-19 vaccine rollout for South Africa and the entire continent has been dealt another hard blow. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, has declared millions of Johnson & Johnson jabs currently in storage at a South Africa port and suitable for use. The doses, along with millions more that were to be distributed across Africa, were produced in Baltimore by a firm called Emergent Biosolutions, which has been tainted by a contamination issue. Darren Terrell reports.
At the beginning of the year, deal after deal for vaccines fell through for the South African government. Then, when it finally got millions of AstraZeneca jabs, they weren't effective against the highly infectious variant in South Africa and were sold to other countries. When the state received 500,000 J&J shots, the FDA temporarily suspended their use, following concerns the vaccine caused blood clots. Now the country's lost 2 million J&J shots contained at the port of Gqeberha. Abeda Williams is spokesperson for J&J South Africa.
What will happen to the doses? So we're going to destroy all the product that has been earmarked by the regulatory authorities, and we're not going to give it to any country. What is good for one country must be good for all countries. We don't feel it's fair to give it to a country, even if they would want to accept it. So we none of those batches.
J&J contracted Aspen Pharmacare to package the vaccines in Gqeberha. Aspen's senior executive, Stavros Nicolaou, confirmed to VOA that other than the South African allocation of 2 million, there were several million more that were supposed to have been used across Africa. Williams says these will also be destroyed.
We've been cautious. All the batches are not contaminated. There was one batch that was contaminated that was destroyed, and the other batches, we've just been cautious that we'd rather not send them out.
She declined to disclose the exact quantity of vaccines to be destroyed or to name all African countries affected.
We've contained the issue. We're working with the governments. We're looking at our supply chain. How we communicate to the public has to be cautious because there's a lot of vaccine hesitancy. And if we scare the public, they're not going to take any vaccine, which is not going to be helpful.
Some scientists have called the J&J jab a game changer for the continent. It's the only vaccine that doesn't require a second booster injection. It also doesn't need super cold refrigeration. But the US FDA has shut the Baltimore plant that was set to produce 220 million J&J shots for Africa, effectively ending the continent's supply until J&J is able to bolster production elsewhere. Fatima Hassan, a lawyer who heads the Health Justice Initiative, says J&J owes South Africa an immediate supply of 2 million FDA-approved vaccines.
The U.S. government funded the research for Johnson & Johnson. The U.S. government has the ability and the power within its own domestic rules and context to actually take action against Johnson & Johnson. And I think that Johnson & Johnson owes the South African public, as well as the rest of Africa, an explanation and I think also an apology.
Hassan says the loss of millions of J&J vaccines in Africa will undoubtedly cause thousands of deaths.
The facts playing out on the ground shows a dire situation of a lack of access, not just in South Africa, but the rest of Africa. And we relied on companies that told us that they've got it under control, that they have enough manufacturers, that they have enough supplies, that they will be able to meet all of our demands. But clearly, we put too much faith in the market and we put too much faith in the CEOs of these companies, and they've really let us down.
Williams says the FDA has approved 300,000 doses of its vaccine for use in South Africa, and those will be delivered later this week. The US government has also pledged to send stocks of Pfizer jabs to the country. G7 country leaders have promised 870 million vaccines to poorer nations. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.